In only 2 days, you can move your career further, faster with a Harvard DCE Professional and Executive Development Program. Advance your leadership skills, craft smarter business strategies, build your network, and move your career in the right direction. You'll earn a certificate of completion, add Harvard to your CV, and become the leader you want to be. Our intensive programs are designed to fit into your busy schedule. Attend online or on the Harvard campus. Search Harvard Professional and Executive Development to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, my name is Michael Mangiello. I've been here at New Books in Psychoanalysis for sometimes sitting in the psychotherapeutic chair of the intern, but today I will be taking the plunge and lying down on the psychoanalytic couch of the host. It's been a pleasure, and I'm eager to begin conducting interviews. Today we'll be speaking with Jean Petruccelli, author most recently of Body States, Interpersonal and Relational Perspectives on the Treatment of Eating Disorders. Jean is director and co-founder of the Eating Disorders, Compulsions, and Addiction Service at the William Allison White Institute, where she's also a supervising analyst and a member of the teaching faculty. Additionally, she serves as adjunct clinical professor of psychology at New York University's postdoctoral program and is in private practice. Now, on to the interview. Jean, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
What drew me to this book was its singularity. I was glad yet surprised to find a book about eating disorders and psychoanalysis. It doesn't seem as though eating disorders receive a lot of attention in psychoanalytic literature. Could you describe how you came to write this book and fill, as it were, this lacuna? And additionally, I was wondering, what was the clinical atmosphere around eating disorders like in 1995 when you founded the Eating Disorders, Compulsions, and Addiction Service? And how has it changed?
Okay. Well, I mean, the analytic world has certainly changed a lot since the 90s. And I thought I would just give you a little background first about myself, because I started working with eating disorder patients in the early 80s after switching from another career in the creative arts. And I came to the William Allison White Institute for analytic training in the late 80s, but it wasn't until the creation of the service, which was then called the Eating Disorders and Substance Abuse Service, that was formed in 1995 with the late Dr. Catherine Stewart. She had a background in addictions, and then we thought we could begin to combine working with eating disorders and addictions with an interpersonal, theory and work with this population. We had, over the years, and when we first started, I had a wonderful steering committee I'm very much a part of this, Jacqueline Flora, Liz Halstead, Jill Howard, Sue Collard, and Molly Sarah-Shawn, and Janet Tintner. And then we later added Carrie Gottlieb. They all have chapters in the book, and we started the training program in 2006. But the real issue, which you can't imagine now, is what we were up against then, because when we first tried to introduce the idea of working with this kind of population in an analytic institute, we were faced with a number of challenges, because we were challenging the preconceived notions of determining, you know, what kinds of patients were thought of as being suitable for analytic treatment. Mm-hmm. Addictions, eating disorders, psychoanalysis, no way. And, you know, now when I look back on it, we were kind of crusaders or rebels and engaged in this battle of, you know, challenging the, what I could say, fooling around the archaic graybeard analyst. Not that I have anything against beards, but, you know, it was a different mindset. Mm-hmm. We were up against the majority of analytic thinking that really thought at the time that there was no trauma or severity of issues regarding eating disorders. We were actually turned down by the trauma service, and we heard things like, you know, eating disorder patients treated at analytic institute, there's no trauma, tell them to just eat salad.
Wow.
I keep not. So, yeah, it was pretty intense, and the field has come a long way. But, you know, just part of the issue for analysts, certainly for classical and even some interpersonalists, was that the concept of thinking about specialization itself didn't fit into the traditional analytic model, because analysis in the traditional sense would think of the treatment of the person as a whole, not the sum of many parts or different cell states or different body states. This is like pre-multiplicity. And what's really interesting now that continues to occur more and more is how patients have issues around food or substance, but it's only in the course of treatment that the analyst or the therapist comes to discover this down the road. So that's why we see so much more in the sense of issues of disordered eating, you know, which is an eating disorder not defined, or just a dysregulated relationship with food or a substance. And we discover it, you know, when with our patients when they're ready to reveal it. And I think this contributes to why more and more analysts now have opened up their minds to working with this population. And I also say that when we first established the eating disorders addictions program, it was also revolutionary because the focus was not on, what we did was we focused on the symptomatology, the manifest content, rather than just thinking about like symbolic interpretation of meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And so we used the principles of interpersonal psychoanalysis and then integrated them with other treatment modalities, also something that was never really done. Like we could use some action-oriented techniques that would have some cognitive behavioral pieces. We would think about setting up a team, working alongside nutritionists, internists, and, mm-hmm. you know, other professionals. So we really began focusing not only on the symptom, but on the impact of on such a focus on the therapeutic dyad. You know, thinking that one's relationship to food would mirror one's relationship to others, and including the relationship between the patient and the analyst.
Mm-hmm.
So, just, you know, anyone who's ever worked with an eating disorder patient knows that it's all about the varied parts that are disowned or dissociated, and there's no way you can avoid on some level getting pulled into the relational dynamics. You have to become a part of it. So you
right.
can't treat this group from the outside, and that's why interpersonal psychoanalysis seems like the perfect fit, because interpersonal psychoanalysis is always taken this as foundational to treating anyone.
Right, right. And you write in some of the chapters in the book about how for eating disorder patients there's a world of food and then the world of people, and a lot of the interpersonal analysis is about the eating disorder patient bringing a person into that world.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. That's right.
And I was wondering, for our listeners' sake, if we could speak a bit about what body states are. So they're called body representations of self states, and it's acknowledged that we all have a number of self states and we transition between them, but the eating disorder patient's problem is that they have trouble living experience between the spaces. There's difficulty in transitioning from one self state to another, because the two are so strongly disassociated from one another. Do I have that right?
Yes, you do, actually. But the way I would start is by saying, like, in order to understand a body state, you have to first start to understand, you know, a self state.
Mm-hmm.
And self states are, they're parts of one's identity. When, you know, renowned analyst Philip Bromberg talks about the idea of self states and, quote, standing in the spaces, because that's really his term.
Mm-hmm.
He's referring to the capacity to feel like oneself while being many. Because, you know, if you think about it, emotional health is, it's not about integration or blending or collapsing parts. It's really about being able to have access to the many parts of our experience. So it's really about the idea of linkage, right? So mm-hmm. you could think of the self state as defined by, you know, what you can be curious about relative to the self state that you're in. And then a body state has to do with embodiment, like the idea of how one lives in their body at a given moment relative to their felt experience. And, you know, embodiment has to do with the healthy ownership within one's, you know, physical core, and that's affected by a lot of things, you know, culture, transmission, genetics, environment.
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, it all works out and when things are in tune, then bodily responses are in tune with emotions, all's good. But when they're not, you have a troubled body.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as psychoanalysts, we increasingly, we see troubled, hurt, disturbed bodies coming into treatment all the time with a lot of, they disown their feelings, they're dissociated. Susie Orbach from London, who was really one of the early people in this field, you know,
right.
She talks about how everyone has a concern about doing right by their body, and it's disguised as a health concern. She really believes that this preoccupation suggests from a longing for a body that's stable,
mm-hmm.
rather than a body experiencing disorganized sensations that just want to be managed. So if you think about it, if the body's mind speaks its own language, and it's an affective language, then the more you learn to listen to it affectively without trying to think about it cognitively, the more fluent it becomes in letting you know what you need to know.
Mm-hmm.
You could say that the body as a self state could be thought of as an adaptive use of normal dissociation. Which can help account for why the language of the body depends on the mind of the body to hold its language as a regulatable kind of experience. The way to think about it in kind of easy terms is like we often like do this thing where we bypass cognition and thinking when we enter into a state that we call like being in the zone or
mm-hmm.
on a roll or in a groove. And we all know this feeling, especially athletes, who sometimes come to it organically. I mean, I'm an avid tennis player for one. I certainly know what it's like to feel in the groove. Let me think. To get back the last part of your question, right?
The part of the question.
To know, how can we pay attention to body states?
Right. How can we, especially in a
clinical context, right? So we have to be aware of the shifts in our own body feelings, you know, the patient and ours as well. And to get at this with patients, I try to ask them things like, do you find that when you remember something meaningful, emotionally painful, that you feel a sensation in your body? And when they do, I ask them where and try to help them become more conscious of the bodily responses, because I might ask them, you know, when their body is bothering them, do they try to ignore it as best as they can? Or are they able to reflect on the idea of what their body can do, and that's more important than what it looks like? So, you know, overall, being aware of body feelings helps the patient become more aware of his or her body feelings and then can give us clues into their unconscious experience. But at the same time, it's also important that we, you know, in our role as therapists, be aware of our body feelings,
mm-hmm.
Because that gives us info into the communication you know, of the other and the relational transmissions that occur between us. So for, you know, for us as therapists, if we're gender conscious, we have to hold the recognition that we also model with subjectivity. So we have to be more than one that contains, tolerates, and survives the transference. We have to stay a subject in our own right, in our own body, which I think is equally as important for therapeutic change.
Right. To sort of maintain that.
So just basically pay attention to the bodies in the room, you know, when the patient mentions your body or physical awareness, you know, how do we listen to that? How do we listen for the interpersonal meanings? You know, how they go to it, when they go to it, why are they focusing on it? How is it being used in the room?
Sure. Listen with an ear for the body.
Yes.
That's great. I'd like to talk now about the origins of an eating disorder. There appears to be an early trauma that leads to disassociation. In her essay in your book, Pat Ogden quotes Bromberg, referring to a disconfirmation in which one part of the child is acknowledged by the caregiver while another part is treated as if it doesn't exist. The child then matures while keeping this disassociated idea of themselves. Concomitant with this trauma is alexithymia, which prevents the child from symbolizing pain. And as a consequence, the trauma and all the thoughts, fantasies, and desires associated with it become stuck in the body. Now, if that's right, and do correct me if I've misunderstood something, then my question is this. How does the eating disorder hold disassociated parts of self and relational history? And I'd also like to ask about your use of the term holding. You mentioned that, quote, and I'm quoting you here, our hope is to inspire patients to tell their story, as well as to accept our willingness to hear their pain without judgment, to hold their disgust, their skeletal pieces, their fat, and their hurt. Could you speak about what you mean by holding here? Do you mean holding close, holding in place? Yeah.
Okay, that's a big question. So I guess first, I'd want to go back to just saying that the idea of, you know, the origins of an eating disorder are multi-determined. I mean, we have to look at it from like a biopsychosocial disorder, and it's a confluence. So nature and nurture go hand in hand in terms of etiology. But to address just one piece of this disorder, which can family involve, like how early trauma leads to dissociation, or how the eating disorder can hold dissociated parts of the self and a relational history, I guess we could start by thinking about the idea of double lives, right? Where a part of the self goes underground. You know, when something feels unbearable, it can't always be processed, or when sometimes things are processed or acted on in the service of some other relational need, which is why then our first job would be to discover, like, all the patient's body cells or parts. And then we have to form a relationship with each part of the patient, because each part holds its own truth, its own reality, and its own agenda. And they all should be taken seriously and accepted without judgment in order to help our patient, you know, ultimately feel less fragmented and more whole. So how to identify the different self and body states, like getting to know these parts of a person, is a really important part of our work, which is not always so easy because these parts are often unformulated. You know, the analyst Don Stern, it's written a great book, Unformulated Experience, and then a newer one, Partners in Thought. But he said in his earlier book, in reference to understanding unformulated experience, that sometimes it's about having to find what you don't know how to look for. And in that sense, I think it's a perfect fit for patients with eating disorders, because it is a place where alexithymia and unformulated experience are really dominant, and that's why their bodies speak in ways, because their minds can't. I'll give you an example, maybe with bulimia. bulimia can be thought of as like the breakthrough of desire, which feeds into greed. Like patients feel like they just can't get enough, because often what happens is someone with bulimia has difficulty identifying or accepting or owning her own needs and her needs of others. So there's this paradoxical nature of the bulimic self that makes it complicated for a therapist to really approach and engage, because bulimic behavior is a contradiction of sorts, because it's both an assertion of self and a punishment for it. So one way to understand this, then, is that they've learned as a child that their needs would really threaten the parent's needs of a narcissistic equilibrium. So what happens is, as a result, the child's needs have to be disavowed. And what you see then is this inherent difficulty that a patient with bulimia has with things like the expression of anger, right, for example. And that's why, you know, one of the traits that is most commonly associated with someone struggling with bulimia is this very pleasing self, or false pleasing self, because that false pleasing self has grown up in compliance with the narcissistic needs of the parent. So then what happens is, if, you know, if you think about it, then the person with bulimia, it's a perfect fit in the sense that the bulimia itself, like in the moments of the bulimic act, they're really stealing a space that's covertly their own through the binging and purging, which, you know, in an ironic sense, are the only moments that are devoted to that person restoring her own sense of self. So, you know, it's complicated, and when needs go underground, you know, something else, it's in the service of something else that, that in that moment takes precedence. But you also asked about the idea of holding, right? The term holding and the idea of holding. So you can think about holding, the idea of holding, like concretely in a bodily way, where a person literally holds a piece of trauma in their body. But we also use the term symbolically, as in like holding an uncomfortable feeling, or holding how someone might think of you thinking of them. So if you take the idea of holding an uncomfortable feeling, well, if you start with the premise that in order to feel whole, with a W, right, one must connect with some of the painful feelings of one's past, rather than like split them off and compartmentalize them. But these parts have an investment in staying separate and unknown to the other parts. So, you know, when a patient has an eating disorder, the goal might be to develop the capacity to negotiate the transitions between these parts or the self states. So it's why we talk about things like putting in a delay so that, that one could think through the consequences of actions and then hold more things than the drive to escape the unbearable feeling, to avoid the discomfort or anesthetize with food. And in order to put in a delay, you know, something that's very important is that we try to help help patients keep this ongoing consciousness, like raise their level of mindfulness through the process of this transition, so that they're not just in that moment overtaken by fear. Meaning that, you know, the last thing someone like in the throes of a binge and purge cycle wants to do is like stop, think, put a delay in, call your therapist, right? It's the last thing that they want to do because it's so impulse-driven. So, and part of the problem is that what you often find with a person with an eating disorder is that they actually feel too much. And so the use of food, or sometimes the lack thereof, becomes a way of being in the world to not feel, and that not feeling feels preferable to them. So if you recovering the capacity to feel and the ability to maintain the feelings without feeling out of control is key, right? Because you can't really feel whole without like an integration of all your feelings. But the paradox is that, you know, while we try to help our patients integrate the feelings, the only way to access them is through first a state of what you could say unintegration, because when, you know, when the patient gives up a symptom, they initially feel really raw. And the problem is they don't have the necessary skills to process their emotions in any manageable way. So then finding the space, or as Bromberg states, standing in the spaces, right, allows us to know our emotions and then allows us to take in other people's feelings as well. When individuals are struggling with an eating disorder, they really tend to avoid their fears by either staying so aloof of their feelings and therefore staying symptomatic, right? And then holding, again, onto their, what we call now, adaptive attempt at a solution to something else. So, you know, maybe it's like, rather than trying to help a person just get rid of the bad feeling, we try to encourage their capacity to face the unfaceable and tolerate the discomfort, the uncomfortableness. And that's what really helps a person feel stronger, because all these things that are disturbing, the emotions and the parts, like, they don't have to be thrown out. They can actually be, you know, really doorways into a greater sense of aliveness if they can be incorporated into their own experience. But maybe learning how to be with these emotions in a new way, then we're challenging, you know, them to form new ways of thinking about how they think about themselves. So that's a long-winded way to explain it, but it's a very complicated system.
Right. No, not long-winded at all, at least to me. I think one thing that's particularly interesting is, you know, allowing the patient to be in his or her own space in a more integrated way. So as you said, the patient who struggles with bulimia, when she is binging or purging, that is her space, but it's a disassociated space because it is all impulse, and the last thing she wants to do is stop and think and call her therapist.
Right, and at that point, she's gotten so far away from even recognizing, like, either knowing what her needs are. So first there's kind of naming, what is it that I'm feeling? What is it that I'm actually wanting, right? And then, can I actually have this space, and is it okay to have them here with the other person, or will it rupture the attachment? You know, since if the historical context has been, you know, I'm not allowed to have my needs, you know, it's like what, you know, whatever mom or dad needs me to be, so to speak.
Right, precisely, sort of living still under the narcissistic parent's shadow.
That's right.
Well, thank you. My next question is actually about the analyst-patient relationship. You write in the introduction that clinicians and researchers continue to grapple with the quest to bridge the gaps in defining a protocol for recovery, knowing that at its core, trust in the reliability of the humanness of the other is a necessary ingredient to help one develop, regain, or have, for the first time, a stable body. Embodied experience must be cultivated and demonstrated in the patient-therapist relationship as a felt experience in its mutuality, so patients can learn to have a body that is lived in rather than experiencing it as an other to be managed. So I'm interested in your idea of the patient and therapist relationship as a felt experience in its mutuality. In your first paper here, you present a vignette in which you make a verbal contract with your bulimorexic patient. She won't purge for a day, and she'll keep a fruit, and she'll keep a food journal. She, in turn, attempts to cure you of your fear of dogs by sending you pictures of her own dog, who she'd like to bring into the room for future sessions. Having established this, you proceed in your paper to examine how this relationship shed light on disowned parts of her. This seemed a good example of the felt experience you mentioned in the introduction. So I was wondering what else the felt experience of analysis and its mutuality could look like. What are the characteristics of the moment? Another way to phrase this question may be, because I know that's a long-formed question, you mentioned that there exist two worlds for the eating disorder patient, the world of food and the world of people. How do you recognize the moment when your patient is sincerely bringing you into the world of food? And how do you distinguish between your patient disassociatively talking about her disorder and your patient actively experiencing knowing it?
Okay. I'm going to try to break this down a bit. So, let's see. I guess I would start by saying, look, we try to bridge the world of food and people by talking the patient's language and entering into her world, right? Mm-hmm. Bringing the symptom in the room by talking in detail and doing a what Sullivan called a detailed inquiry about, you know, what happens, when it happens, what the triggers are, how it happens, etc. Sometimes we bridge the concrete world of food through, I have been playing around with this for quite some time, using actual, like, food metaphors that that reach affective states, and also as using them as communications within relationships that tell something of, like, either the relational history and what will be is at stake, you know, and how it plays out in the therapy relationship. Like things like how patients binge on us, ideas will percolate, you know, the idea of digestion, what can be held, what can't be held. So sometimes they will, they can't hold the feeling, so they'll purge in words. You know, often a patient will say things like, I can't stomach that, you know, and so it's interesting, when even like parts of the body are brought in, you know, because the world of food is such a closed system to them. So we really try to get in any way possible, because the patient who struggles with an eating disorder has really withdrawn from relatedness, because, you know, getting needs and desires met in any early attachment relationship was, you know, sometimes impossible or toxic or dangerous. So we really try to work to rebuild those links that have been severed. In that example with my patient with the dog, you know, I was trying to be kind of with her in the moment of vulnerability. So she was not risking something alone. She was not the only one with her shame, and I was kind of playing, but really offering up my vulnerability in the mix, my fear of dogs, which is really true and has really changed over the course of time. It's had to, you know.
Yeah, very interesting.
By hook or crook, there are probably more dogs that have come into my office than I can count. But, you know, I did it with her, and one of the bridges was also, like, using playing.
Mm-hmm.
Because playing is something which is also sometimes very severely curtailed for the constricted, you know, eating disorder, a person with an eating disorder. And so, you know, there are many ways that in many different ways that I might try to bring in and make a bridge. I mean, sometimes, like, on a concrete bodily level, I could give you an example of how, a body part was referenced in a way that allowed me to kind of talk about something very painful with a patient. I had a 19-year-old woman with anorexia. She was on medical leave from college. I was seeing her for a short period of time, but she kept identifying her thighs as the culprit for everything that troubled her. And one day, just out of the blue, as she walked in, she commented on how she felt my thighs looked good in pants. And then we started to explore what were her feelings about my thighs, and then her thighs, and then discussion of the function of thighs and the shapes of thighs. And as we were going on and on about this, what we uncovered was she had a memory when she was 9 years old and was held over her grandfather's head to see above a crowd, and she remembers feeling his fingers creep around her thighs into her genital region. She remembers feeling physically unable to move and emotionally frozen. And she remembers, you know, as he thrust his fingers into her, she said, "You've never spoken these words out loud."
Wow.
It was a really poignant moment between us because it demonstrated so viscerally how bodies can really concretize and hold the internal and the historical experience. You know, when being faced with the horror of her experience, well, you find yourself, and we as therapists find ourselves, like, first wanting to offer reassurance and comfort rather than just holding their distress and hearing their pain, which is really what I did with her. And that helped allow those body parts to come into the room. Well, you know, when this, when this patient compared my, you know, in quotes, my idealized in her my thighs to her thighs, it was a way that she could bring in her, I would say in quotes, her damaged or defective thighs in her mind, and to begin to address her pain about this frightened and hated body part. It filled her with shame, anger, and disgust. And I think without our directly addressing her thighs, you know, her pain couldn't begin to lessen. So this is just an example in which, you know, her disowned body experience, which she could not connect to her thighs, but by using my thighs, it became safer, and you know, she could talk about it. That's on a concrete level, but you also, I guess, to mention, I guess the idea of holding it on a symbolic level, because patients with eating disorders, you know, they have no way to process, like, the things they feel, their affects, through self-reflection or mentalization. And so if they can't use symbolic or metaphoric thought, then the body has to hold things. So, you know, and that's why, like, they can feel so enslaved by their inability to contain desire as anything that's regulatable. So they have to get rid of it. And so it's very difficult for them to kind of just hold feeling states as well.
Right. The unthought thought gets stuck in the body.
That's right.
I love your example as well, because I feel it epitomizes what interrelational analysis can bring to the treatment of eating disordered patients.
Yeah. And I guess it's, you know, because we're, I mean, really what we're talking about is the idea of, you know, being able to sit with one's feelings, like hold an idea in mind, right? And that's the difficulty that these people really face.
Right. That reminds me of another consideration I had while reading the book, namely sort of wrestling with the idea of participant-observer. You know, it's clear that the eating disordered patient has trouble being a participant-observer in her own life. And my question for you was, you know, do you find that the eating disordered patient is more participant than observer? Is she acting without thinking, or is the eating disordered patient more observer than participant? Is she knowing about what she does without changing how she acts. Perhaps both. I don't know. It's you know, sort of hard to parse this into neat categories.
You really read this book carefully. I'm impressed. I think it's an interesting question, right, on many levels. Because if you think about the idea of knowing, it's really about, I think it's a process of sort of knowing, right? When mm-hmm. someone can actually know what they know, they don't want to know, and also in the sense of like how these patients know things in a way with their bodies, turning to food almost like a drug of sorts that really is meant to help regulate the overwhelming mental or emotional distress, and then they have to get rid of what their minds can't contain or know because they can only sort of know it. So they might know they're in it, but they don't feel like they can do anything about it. We could say, I guess, as human beings, I think we're always all trying, hopefully, to balance being in our felt experience with also being able to observe and reflect on them. Mm-hmm. But patients with eating disorders tend to fall down on one side or the other, and you could see the impulsive, reactive behavioral acts if they, step into a binge or a binge and purge cycle of being only like a participant in that moment, or when they're caught in the mercy of their feelings rather than being able to digest and reflect on them. They feel like, they're stuck like hamsters on a wheel, falling in the same old pattern. And you could actually say they're acting without thinking, mm-hmm. right? Because, what they tell you is that they feel like they're held hostage by the intruders in their heads. They're consumed by secrets. They'll speak of sudden surges of hunger or these insistent food thoughts, rituals, silent fears. But what's interesting is that, even though they sink into this, pattern, the inevitable pattern of their behavior, they wake each morning and they're determined to end this tortured relationship. They can say things like, I gotta be good, I'm only going to eat vegetables, I'm only going to resist temptations, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But, what happens is that they make these promises to themselves, but when these promises collide with the emotions that overwhelm them, then the promise just completely disintegrates. And then in that fraction of a second, that something just happens, right? And the resolve disappears, and it's like they lose their minds, right? They can't recall why they should do anything but eat foods that maybe just a few minutes before they had no thought or hunger for. And so, they repeatedly turn to food for purposes other than feeding and nutrition and all that, and then their bodies seek ways to eliminate what they've taken in, and then they feel despair in the process. So, when you ask, does the person with an eating disorder know about what she does without changing how she acts, or perhaps both? I mean, I think at some point she knows that she's choosing to numb, right? It's because there's so much despair that's brought about by the cycle.
Right.
I think it's cloaked in the fear of eating or being, quote, fat or craving foods that are dangerous or bad or on the bad food list or having others see them or not seeing them as they are. And these states can be used to numb or anesthetize experience or deaden feelings or to observe themselves only in relation to others, especially around weight and eating behaviors and food. Patient with an eating disorder can be thinking, if she's eating that, I will eat less or more, as the case would be, rather than trying to read the internal or subjective cues. It's played out with food, of course, but also with feelings and wants and desires. So the patients are either at the mercy of the felt experience of objectifying and scrutinizing themselves and others, and they have no access to the internal cues.
Right.
Above.
Yeah, it's a question that it's very rewarding to discuss, but it's always still there. And I think,
yeah, because you know, there's one of the, just to be clear about, like, there's so many, like, the concept of knowing itself is so complicated,
right?
You know, how do we, what do we know, not know, and then that whole, it's that's why I feel like so much of it is really in sort of knowing, because it's never about just the cognitive knowing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if that was the case, you just, you know, every patient knows, like sticking a fork down her throat, ripping out her esophagus, like, is that really a good thing?
Right.
That's why, like, you can't talk rationally. It's not about that kind of knowing.
Right, especially because with the eating disordered patient, there's been an impediment to symbolization.
Right, that's right. That's right.
Right. Now, I don't know, I had another question, but I think I'd like to skip ahead to something just because I feel like it relates to what we were just speaking about. To move ahead a little bit to your second essay, My Body is a Cage, you open by writing that, quote, eating disorders are maladaptive attempts to survive the unbearable, both psychologically and psychophysiologically. What you're referring to here is different than simple repression. And, you know, we've been talking so much about interrelational analysis and, you know, the ways in which it is different than, you know, other sorts. So I was wondering if you would mind describing for our listeners what for you distinguishes eating disorders from repression in general.
Yes, yeah, I have to reframe this question a bit to make it more sense. For me, in terms of like how I think about this work, because I don't really use the word repression, so I prefer to think about things in terms of dissociation, and I'd rather talk about like the role of dissociation, because you know repression is not simple. I mean, there are people who have written many, many books and many scholarly articles on the difference between dissociation and repression. I mean, that's a whole different discussion,
right?
And I think one that takes it in a different direction than a lot of the things that this book is about, and certainly where how I'm thinking about it. So I would rather kind of look at and say that like much of the most fruitful contemporary psychoanalytic work on eating disorders has involved understanding eating disorders as dissociative processes. Right. So, if we start from that premise, then we could say that you know there have been affective states that have not historically been tolerable or manageable, and that has threatened needed connections to early attachment figures, and so what cannot be represented and tolerated cognitively and affectively is often then dissociated. So it's literally delinked from its meaning, and it's held as a concrete yet, you know, unsymbolized form of pain. And for an eating disorder patient, I think for many reasons, these undigested experiences become compartmentalized into feelings about the body, and they're split off from the self, they're split off from the self the patient can't stand to be. And they're controlled and then acted out through the symptoms. At the same time, the symptoms induce dissociation, you know, often allowing like a person to escape the unnatural pain they would otherwise face, the loss or the shame or the terror. That's the way I would think about it.
Right, right.
So, you know, repression really comes from, it puts it back into a more kind of top-down model. And so I think that these parts exist simultaneously, but the connections between them aren't there, as opposed to not being able to find it.
Right.
Or not being able to, you know, have access to it in a different way.
Right. It's a different set of questions completely when you're talking about dissociation as opposed to repression, it sounds.
Yeah, I mean, that has been a big debate in the field. There are conferences just on that topic alone.
Well, it's a shame we don't have more time to go into those debates. As it stands, we regrettably only have a few minutes left. So I think for my final question for you, you know, you spoke earlier in the interview about how there are cultural transmissions, and you know, there are discussions in the book about how body image is transmitted from the mother to the daughter. As you say in the Body Group penned essay, The Acquisition of a Body, the mother's embodiment of the psychological shape and possibilities of gender is the child's initial access to the world. From her culturally imbued body, the mother consciously and unconsciously, materially and imaginatively engages with her daughter's developing body, just as she engages with her daughter's developing emotional life. In the same essay, one will find that how she, the mother, relates at a psychological and physical level with her daughter is her idiomatic honing of the very context that have shaped her. And while I was reading this, the title of an old Eric Fromm book came to mind, The Sane Society. The theme of that book being, of course, that it's to be expected that people feel ill when they're living in an ill society. So I suppose my question for you is, what kind of wellness can women find living in an unwell culture where the contradictory expectations of womanhood are played out in the body? And, you know, how can one really respond to the fact that a patient cannot affect change in a culture in the same way that she may affect actual change in her personal relationships?
Yeah, boy. Yeah, it's a tough world that we live in. You know, we live in this society where young girls believe that, you know, bodies define who they are. And, you know, even though I think the cultural influence is only one piece of the puzzle, but nonetheless, you know, very important one, the message and the cultural imperatives, they're powerful, they're damaging, you know, and they definitely have an impact on young girls in terms of them, you know, turning to, you know, these eating disorder behaviors in an attempt to manipulate the body to fit into this unrealistic standard of beauty, and they become trapped in this negative cycle of body hatred. You know, from day one, we're living in a cultural body. We could say the media, you know, certainly projects and brands young women and young men, and the mother-daughter intergenerational transmission is also so important because that extends the feeding of cultural messages. You know, the body group, which I'm really happy to be part of, that was led, spearheaded by Cece Orbach and some women from the Women's Therapy Center, the whole point of putting together and creating an instrument was to really try to focus on more of this intergenerational transmission and understand the ways in which, how culture and the transmission of embodiment really can come into the room and people, we can talk about it. Because, you know, what we find clinically so often is that there's this merger that grows out of a mother's anxiety about what it means to live in a female body, and that gets passed on to her child. And then the message that's conveyed is to seek feelings of empowerment and self-definition through using her body, by using bodies to control and identify with these cultural ideas of women as commodities. And what happens is when vulnerabilities are not recognized, or they're not valued, or one's sense of agency is not supported, because, you know, the old expression, you know, mother knows best, isn't really true. We have, it doesn't work. I mean, so when you ask, like, what kind of wellness can women find, you know, living in an unwell culture, there's so many contradictions, and they're played out in the body. You know, the messages would be sexually objectified and claim agency at the same time. It's a very interesting and complex issue, and I think we're trying to work on changing the cultural message. But one thing that might be, I could think about that's useful from an analytic perspective is the focus maybe on individual difference, because, you know, we know that even though things are as they are culturally, some women manage to integrate a sense of agency and pass this along to their daughters, and others don't. Some women feel good in their body and others don't. And the question is why, and what happens developmentally and in the processing and transmission of cultural messages through family relationships and history. You know, I don't know. I mean, I think that this is a question that we're going to really continue to be looking at for quite some time.
Yeah, but as we do continue looking at it, I would count us lucky to have your thoughts on them. Thank you so much for your answer and your time today, Jean. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Oh, well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure speaking with you as well. I appreciate your interest very much in this topic.
We would be happy to have you back anytime as you continue doing your work. But for now, this is Michael Mangiello signing off on Nubix in Psychoanalysis. Till next time.